Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Last month, 28-year-old Democratic Socialist Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez rocked the Democratic establishment after defeating 10-term incumbent Congressman Joe Crowley in New York's 4th House District, which includes the Bronx. Crowley was seen as a possible replacement for Nancy Pelosi as the leader of the House Democrats. He was the number 4 Democrat in the House, so this is a very big deal. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, an organizer who worked on Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign, was a bartender just last year. She ran on a progressive platform that includes tuition-free college, health care for all, and climate justice. Now, turnout in that district was very low. It was just 12%. But Ocasio-Cortez won with 57% of the vote. She was immediately catapulted onto the national stage and is now endorsing progressive candidates across the country. And this has a lot of people asking whether the Democratic Party can be transformed from within. How will the corporate wing of the party respond to someone like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez? Joining us to talk about these issues today are two guests. Kate Aronoff is a contributor to The Intercept and a writing fellow at In These Times, covering climate change and politics. Hi, Kate. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. We're also joined by Norman Solomon, a writer and activist who co-authored the independent report Autopsy, The Democratic Party in Crisis. Norman Solomon was elected from the North Bay as a Bernie delegate to the 2016 Democratic National Convention. He's national coordinator of RootsAction.org, an online group that now has 1.2 million active supporters. And he's the author of a dozen books, including War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits keep spinning us to death. Hi, Norman. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Rose.
Well, it's great to have both of you. Let's start off by just talking about the significance of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's win. Norman, let's start off with you. Alexandria raised $600,000 from small donors. Joe Crowley raised $3 million. His donors include Facebook's Sheryl Sandberg, Salesforce, Google, Raytheon, Boeing. I mean, almost every major corporate donor gave money to Joe Crowley. And yet Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez won with 57% of the vote. How significant is this victory, Norman?
Well, it's turned out to be very significant. It's in the category of they said it couldn't be done, they being pundits and just basic conventional wisdom. And certainly it's an uphill climb when, as is almost always the case, progressives are outspent when they run for office. There's also what might be called the media primary, where the tenor and tone and volume of media coverage, both news and commentary, tilts usually for the corporate establishment candidates. Showing that this can be done, I think, is very important because there's been a sort of a concept, which is only partly true, that progressives have a extremely difficult path if they want to win in the party or as part of the Democratic Party. And what happened in the Queens and Bronx a few weeks ago is that it was shown to be possible.
And Kate, The Intercept was one of the few media outlets to actually cover Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's race. She got very little media coverage other than really like The Intercept, The Young Turks, progressive groups, outlets, I should say. Can you talk about the significance of her victory?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's huge. I mean, Norman sort of laid that out. But I think it opens the field, and we're already seeing particularly candidates who have been considered too sort of left-wing to be elected on the fringe get a bigger spotlight. And I think it's really opened up people's minds, and in particular, you know, the media, I think, is now much, much more likely to cover sort of insurgent Democrats who are sort of coming at this from the left. And I think it's really sort of shaken the ground, both within the party of thinking about, you know, a new sort of type of leadership that's coming up, particularly from sort of younger candidates, more left-wing candidates, and just folks who are broadly around politics and thinking about what the sort of realm of the possible can look like.
It's always interesting to see how the media label ideas, label candidates, label things like healthcare for all. And so many outlets and headlines are saying, you know, will the Dems become left? Are they moving too far left, right? We hear that far left. And before we really get into this discussion, can we talk a little bit about context? Because, Norman, so many of the things that we're talking about are already in place in many European countries, like healthcare for all, tuition-free college, higher taxes, subsidized childcare. I remember interviewing a teacher in Finland since Trump was just there, and he talked about how teachers are they're just treated very differently in Finland. The kids have very healthy food. He doesn't have a problem finding health care for his child because it's subsidized. And when Bernie was running, Bloomberg had a piece called "In Europe, Sanders would be center-right." So can we just give this a little bit of context?
Yes, part of the context is that in Europe, the New York Times and Washington Post would be considered center-right as well. And yet here, we routinely are told what a liberal media we have. And I think it goes to the point that you're raising, where what is considered by the mass media and portrayed as such as left wing and so forth often gets very strong majority support, whether it's Medicare for all or whether it is free public college for everyone. The polling in this country is really showing support among the population that's not shared by the punditocracy in Washington and major political reporters from the biggest outlets. And I think that's a context. It's that sort of disconnect that is to a large degree replicated between the base of the Democratic Party and the leadership, people like Chuck Schumer in the Senate, Nancy Pelosi in the House. That's a gap that has festered. And what we saw in the victory that defeated this establishment incumbent, Joe Crowley, is that the gap is significant and it can be utilized to defeat the corporate status quo.
Another fact that's important to raise is we always hear about taxes. How will we pay for all of these things? And of the 35 richest countries in the world, the United States ranks 32nd in total tax burden. The only countries that pay less are Mexico and Chile. This is according to T.R. Reid, who wrote a book about taxes. Kate, what would you add on this question just around how all of this is being framed in the media and the labels that are used, left, left-wing, far left?
That's funny because a lot of the programs, you know, things that show up in Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's platform, for instance, things like a federal job guarantee, a Green New Deal, these are programs that, like Norman said, they poll very well. Data for Progress did, a think tank did a poll sort of gauging support for a federal job guarantee and found overwhelming support among voters in every state. And so there's nothing particularly radical. I think there's just a sort of tendency for particularly mainstream outlets to kind of cast any sort of big universal program as being somehow socialist or Marxist. And I think, you know, there's a grain of truth to that. But also, you know, we've had programs which could in a certain sense be considered, you know, socialist-like, things like Social Security, Medicare, which we don't really think of in that way, but the principle is the same, that there should be, you know, a public option for people to readily get things that we deem important in society. And I think something that's been interesting, too, to watch the media sort of respond to after Ocasio-Cortez's victory is, as you mentioned, this question of spending and you know, how we tax, how we spend. And I'm personally very excited for that to be a very different conversation. I think even Democrats can sort of fall into this trap that Republicans created of saying we need to pay off programs with tax revenue, and that's simply just not how budgets are made at the federal level, certainly. And I think Ocasio-Cortez has given some really sort of exciting answers in that regard, and being asked, you know, how will you pay for a federal job guarantee? How will you pay for free college? Saying that, you know, rightfully so, that question never gets asked when we go to war. That question doesn't get asked when we pass a tax cut for millionaires. And so I think that will be something really interesting to watch as more candidates who, you know, are coming with that understanding are hopefully elected. And you know, how do we prioritize things that we think are important and spend accordingly on, you know, giving people what arguably they should have as a right.
Kate Aronoff is contributor to The Intercept and a writing fellow at In These Times. Norman Solomon is a writer, longtime activist. He co-authored the independent report Autopsy, The Democratic Party in Crisis. He's the author of many books, including War Made Easy. And today on Your Call, we are talking about whether it's possible to reform the Democratic Party from within. This is a question that a lot of people have been asking for a very long time. And we're now asking this again because of the victory of the Democratic Socialist Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in the primary in New York. It's the 14th House District, which includes Queens and the Bronx. And people are saying that she's almost certain to win in November. She's endorsing a number of progressive candidates across the country. So what are your thoughts? Do you think the Dems can be reformed from within? What has the past really shown you? If there's a candidate that you followed who you really agreed with, who had progressive leanings, what happened when she or he went to Washington? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. And if you're looking at some of the candidates running now, what is exciting you for November? Norman, you have been in politics for quite a while. What can you tell us about this long-term question that so many are asking? You know, what has happened in the past when truly progressive candidates won and went to Washington, D.C.?
Well, I think that they've hit often a wall, and yet they've had some real impacts by reframing the debate in the longer term. You know, the so-called Watergate class in 1974, of course, now are part of the aging and often, in most cases, now retired power structure among the Democrats in Congress. But it has a real impact, and it's sometimes a percolating one that takes a frustrating amount of time. When we frame this in terms of can the Democratic Party be significantly improved within the Democratic Party, I think it could be valuable to, along the way, reframe it as you're never going to change significantly in a major way the Democratic Party from within if you keep in mind that the base is not really within the Democratic Party. Where, mm-hmm. you know, the vast majority of people who vote for Democrats have nothing to do with the party other than the ballots that they cast. So they're sort of, you might say, ex officio members. And so, in a sense, yes, we can make huge changes potentially in terms of who are Democrats who become members of the House and Senate and state legislature and so forth. But the pressure has to come from the base, which has, you might say, some toes in the party, but is largely disconnected from it on a daily basis.
Well, this is a good point, because on June 1st, the AP reported that for the very first time, Republicans are the third largest bloc of voters in California. New data released by the Secretary of State in California shows that voters with no party preference represent 25.5% of registered voters. Republicans make up 25%, Dems make up 44%. So independents are really growing in the state of California and across the country. Right, Norman?
Well, yes, and nationally, it's actually there are more people who are, as we call it here, declined to state, but independent voters than Democrats. And this is what makes it especially striking and in some ways just wacky that you have the establishment leaders of the Democratic Party very eager to keep the club to themselves and to define who is a Democrat and who is not. On her book tour last fall, Hillary Clinton went out of her way to be derisive towards Bernie Sanders, saying on TV, he's not even a Democrat, as though that's somehow a negative when it comes to outreach. Well, if the Democratic Party does not reach out to people who don't identify as Democrats, it's not going to get very far.
Well, and then, Kate, Nancy Pelosi was asked about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's victory right after she won, and she basically said that it's ascendant in that district, perhaps, quote, but I don't accept any characterization of our party presented by the Republicans, so let me reject that right now. Our party is a big tent. Our districts are very different from one another. Each of our members is elected to be the representative of their district, so nobody's district is representative of somebody else's district, end quote. What are your thoughts on how she was asked about the rise of democratic socialism within the party?
Well, I think she's wrong, certainly. I mean, the idea that socialism or, you know, left-leaning universal programs are only popular in places like New York City, I think, is flat wrong. I mean, I've been working on a story about the Democratic Socialists of America and found out that Iowa actually has the highest per capita number of members of that organization. And you know, the socialist history of the United States is really a story of Midwestern cities. It's places like Milwaukee, which had a socialist mayor, was sent socialist to Congress. The Midwest has, you know, has a sort of rich history, and other parts of the country do as well. But I think something that I've seen getting a little bit lost in that conversation about, you know, is socialism ascendant in the Democratic Party is just a real question of what organizing looks like. And that, you know, it's, I think Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's victory comes down, on the one hand, to the fact that these ideas are exciting, that people are, you know, really getting behind things like Medicare for All. But on the other hand, it was really a question of turnout. And Joe Crowley, by all accounts, had really no ground game. I mean, he relied on a very standard set of tactics that are pretty universal across a certain type of corporate Democrat, which is, you know, there are mailers that are sent out, maybe some phone calls, maybe a couple of people who go and knock doors. But I think what really made the difference on the ground for New York 14 was people just going out and talking to voters, and particularly talking to voters who aren't likely to vote in these types of races, in primaries. And, you know, turnout has been historically very low in that district, and it was still low, but higher, you know, in a sense, than it has been, particularly among folks who again, don't turn out to those sorts of races. And so I think it's both a question in thinking about the future for Democrats of, you know, what sort of ideas are popular, but also how it can become a party that really organizes, how it can become a party that is willing to talk to new voters in a way that many candidates just simply haven't been. So you know, I think democratic socialism is ascendant, but arguably too, what's ascendant are candidates who are really willing to get out there and speak to the folks in their districts.
Kate Aronoff is a contributor to The Intercept, and Norman Solomon is a writer, activist, and author. Let's take a few calls before we go to break. Let's hear from Buddy in San Francisco. Hi, Buddy. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi.
Hi. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay. So, I just called with a comment because, like, you know, I heard the very beginning about how, you know, like you said, Bernie would be center-right in Europe. So I'm a tour guide in San Francisco. I do German tours, and I happen to actually in the last year spend 3 days up in Yosemite with this family. It was the older man and his two kids and all his grandkids, so like this huge family. He was the editor of Die Welt for like 15 years, Manfred Schell. One of his sons is on the board of directors of Daimler Credit. So, you know, these guys are pretty conservative. Die Welt is a really conservative newspaper. It's from Axel Springer, which is, you know, he was like the Rupert Murdoch, but, you know, of Germany back in the day. So, you know, these guys are pretty conservative. And like I was explaining to them, they wanted to know what is up with Donald Trump, which is one of the reasons I love my job, is I get to explain that. So I was using, you know, I was saying, well, you know, like, these guys, they're out to destroy the government. I was saying, like, every head of every department has spent their life trying to destroy that department. And I use Betsy DeVos as an example. She's one of my personal favorites. So, and, you know, how they're trying to destroy and privatize public education here. And he, the guy was the event editor, he goes, you can't do that. Public education, that's the bedrock of democracy. I said, wow, you know, like, you would be a communist in this country.
Well, if I could jump in here, I mean, let's face it. Under the Obama administration, there were great strides made towards privatization, towards charter schools. And so we have this pattern of the Democratic Party from the top aiding and abetting a lot of these strong pushes from the right wing of the Democratic Party, only doing it more incrementally. And something else I want to point out here is that in contrast to the German system and much of Europe, most of Europe, we don't have a parliamentary system. And so that is a point often lost by those who want to run for the U.S. Congress or the state legislature through the Green Party or the Peace and Freedom Party. It's not going to work. It doesn't work, and one of the reasons is structural. So it argues for realizing that, like it or not, the Democratic Party is the vehicle for making these electoral changes.
Like Bill Clinton used to say, where else are you going to go?
Exactly. That's what we have conversations about that on the show on a regular basis. Buddy, that's a really great insight. It would be so interesting to have a couple tour guides on the show to learn more about the conversations you have with people around the world.
Yeah, around the world, because I spend all my time with foreigners. And here's one more little interesting thing. Like I do Spanish, too. So, like, of course, you know, Donald Trump in Mexico, everybody's like, the first question is, Donald Trump, what's up with that? I had one Latino who was pro-Trump, and, you know, this guy happened to be, had to spend all day alone with him and his girlfriend. It was like 12 hours to Carmel. And, you know, like, so I said, Donald Trump, and he goes, oh, finally a president American can be proud of. And you know what this guy does? He was a lawyer who sold Panama Papers stamps. So he was a Panamanian lawyer. And that's what his job. He's the only one who thought Donald Trump is great. So I just said, okay, we're going to leave that alone.
Wow. Well, thank you so much, buddy. Sounds like you have a great job. Enjoy Yosemite. Thank you for calling in with that story. Let's take one more caller before break. GS in South Lake Tahoe. Hi, GS.
Yes, thank you. Very good. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, you're fine. Go ahead.
Okay, very good. Well, obviously, we have to think long term for a lot of us to come together. Seems to me right now we are stuck, as has been said, with a kind of bipolar legislature. We've got the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. Yes, I was a Bernie guy. They're, you know, socialist-leaning parties, but has been also, well, we could have a parliamentary democracy with Green, Peace and Freedom, socialist parties, but yes, for now, sort of stuck with the Democrats versus the Republicans. So, but, it, you know, it's other things that are structured. Everybody who gets a Social Security number should automatically register to vote.
GS, sorry to cut you off, but you're cutting out. Do you have a question?
Oh, I'm so sorry. Well, hold on. Let me switch to speaker here. Is this any better?
I'm not sure yet, but go ahead. GS. If you can call back with a better line or even email your question, and I'll be sure to ask it, yourcall@kalw.com. Sorry about that. We just couldn't hear you very well. On today's Your Call, we are talking about whether or not it's possible to change the Democratic Party, either with a lot more progressives, change it from within, take on the corporate wing. There's lots of different strategies. What are your thoughts on this? This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
3D printing is not the future. It's changing the world right now. With a few instructions and the right technology, you can print anything from a gallbladder to a gun. How will 3D printers impact our ability to innovate? And how might they challenge our laws on intellectual property, free speech, and criminal justice? Next time on 1A.
That's one half hour from now at 11 a.m. right here on KALW. This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's toll-free, 866-798-8255. And you can post a comment or question on the website at yourcallradio.org or tweet us at Your Call Radio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We'll be discussing the fallout from Trump's joint press conference with Vladimir Putin. Trump is facing so much backlash for denying Russia's meddling into the presidential elections. So what is the real story here? Can we just get to the real story? What does the indictment actually say, the latest Robert Mueller indictment? How are the media covering this just beyond, well, Trump says he used the wrong word? What is the real story? We'll talk about that tomorrow. Today, we are talking about how to really change the Democratic Party, especially the corporate wing of the party. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. What do you think of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's victory last month? She's a 28-year-old Democratic socialist, and she beat Congressman Joe Crowley, who's the number four Dem in the House. He was seen as a possible replacement for Nancy Pelosi. He raised $3 million from Boeing, Google, Facebook, a number of corporations, and she raised $600,000 from mostly small donors. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Kate Aronoff is a contributor to The Intercept and a writing fellow at In These Times. And Norman Solomon is a writer and activist. He was elected from the North Bay as a Bernie delegate to the 2016 Democratic National Convention. He's written a number of books. War Made Easy is one of them, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. And we've got full lines. Let's go to Lisa in San Francisco. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having this program. You know, I was going to comment about what the previous caller had said, but what's more important is to talk about the issue that you have on the table here. And unfortunately, I've been participating through the primary system, to voting as Democrat in the primary system to try to push forth a more progressive platform for quite some time. I remember the 1988 elections where Jesse Jackson got in California. He got 21% of the vote, but only 7% of the delegates. So I mean, there's a lot of issues. There's too many damn blocks, you know, that they've placed, and one of the most, you know, obvious ones was what the Democrats did to Bernie Sanders anytime any kind of progressive platform comes forth. And that's basically because of the donors. I mean, seriously, right after, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez had won, she backpedaled on her position regarding Palestine. Not completely, but, I'm sure she has a lot more that she wants to learn about it before being able to formulate a more coherent position. But in reality, that seemed to me that they were applying some level of pressure, and that's because AIPAC is an incredibly powerful lobby organization which lobbies the Democrats, and Democrats have been involved in a lot of the things that we're accusing the Trump administration for, and specifically supporting the 1%, the bank bailout, we're talking about they have their hands in the cookie jar just as much as the Republicans. The only difference.
Well, Lisa, on your point about economic issues, this is a really important one. Kate or Norman, did you happen to hear that This American Life segment called "It's My Party and I'll Try If I Want To"? Everybody should listen to this. It's fascinating. It's about Jeff Beals, who decided to run in the Democratic primary in the 19th district in New York. He's a progressive. He's got a lot of the same platforms as Ocasio-Cortez. And he learned that the leaders in the party basically said, unless you can raise millions of dollars from big money and lobbyists, we're just not going to work with you. And the takeaway was, the big money donors are fine with LGBT rights, reproductive rights, and gun control. But their support ends once you start talking about the rigged economic system, inequality, and taxes. Kate, did you happen to hear that?
Go ahead, Kate.
I didn't hear that specific segment, but I mean, I think that's right. I mean, what we've seen in this primary season has been some of these big institutions within what, you know, within the Democratic Party, like the DCCC, sort of intervening on behalf of candidates who are able to raise huge sums of money from very few people. And it's a huge Democratic problem, I think. And there are candidates, I mean, Ocasio-Cortez swore off corporate donors, raised money through small donors, and that's, you know, been a successful strategy for a lot of these insurgent candidates. And it's very, you know, it's a huge barrier to entry for progressive candidates when, you know, the common wisdom that people will get asked when they are thinking about running for office is, can you raise $100,000 out of the contacts in your phone just by, you know, calling up people that you know? And so I think there, you know, has to be a real sort of frame shift, both to like you said, you know, have people be not accountable to huge donors who are traditionally very hostile to really big progressive redistributive policies, and, you know, just have these candidates be accountable to the people who are actually electing them. And, you know, I think small donor fundraising is a really crucial part of that, just to, you know, change who it is that candidates are listening to.
Norman, what would you add?
Yes, it's become clear that we can raise significant amounts of money through small donor donations, a lot of it online, maybe usually not as much as the corporate candidates, but significantly. The district that you mentioned, Rose, in New York includes Woodstock and Kingston, and I was there a few weeks ago before the election, and one of the dynamics was that the progressive candidates split the vote, and that helped the corporate candidate to win. That sometimes happens, and frankly, a big problem is that progressive candidates quite often come in late and come out without adequate planning, kind of like an impulse item. They're in the supermarket checkout line, and quite often they think, oh, hey, I think I'd like to grab that candy bar. I think I'd like to run for Congress. That's ridiculous. And one of the things that happened with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is that she planned way ahead. She really thought it out. She built human infrastructure, so to speak, so that it was really a challenge. And Kate, I thought, made one of the great points she's made was a few minutes ago about the importance of organizing on the ground, really canvassing, really having a long-term plan that is implemented not just through media, but through people reaching out to people. And if we get to San Francisco, this is what's been lacking time after time when the corporate candidate, Nancy Pelosi, cruises to re-election. And although she might wish that she could be in Congress forever, being mortal, she can't. And so in the next 2 or 4 years, it's quite probable that progressives will have an opportunity, if they can coalesce and do this right, to get a genuine progressive finally into that seat.
Well, this is a good point, Norman, because Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, when she was interviewed, said, you know, I knocked on so many doors and I met young people who've never voted before. They voted for the first time ever. And in the past, they just kind of felt like they were taken advantage of. And for the first time, someone actually spoke to them and said, what are your needs? What do you want from a candidate?
Yes, and it goes to your point as well about the pandering process that is routine from the so-called leadership of the Democratic Party, where when it gets to bedrock economic issues, the rhetoric aside, they're basically aligned with Wall Street. So important issues of feminism and gay rights and civil rights, yes, to a large extent, the Democratic Party hierarchy is there. But when it comes to bread and butter issues of how the economic pie is cut up, they've got most of their marbles with Wall Street.
Well, and we should say, because we have a lot of gay rights activists listening, that they do a lot for gay marriage and for the kind of mainstream issues. But when it comes to like trans issues, LGBT homelessness, It would be nice if they would do more on those issues.
Yes.
Well, thank you again for calling in. Let's go next to GS. Oh, hi, GS. You're back. If you could quickly ask your question.
Yes, I'll keep it really, really short. This got to be a better connection here. In the very long term, it's sort of obvious that we need to get a more progressive, let's say, Democratic Party in control of both the House and the Senate. Toward that, I believe we must have the public, the citizens, registered to vote automatically. When anybody applies for a Social Security number, they should automatically be registered as eligible to vote. You know, whether they choose Democrat, Republican, Green, whatever, they're registered to vote. Then the rest is getting them out to vote. Anyway, with a more progressive Democratic Party for now in control of both the House and the Senate, we can vote to raise taxes on the rich. This is one of the most important things, so that we fund all the things you've been talking about, college all the way through, a degree, a college degree, maybe even a master's or a PhD, funded by the state. So there's no issue of whether or not you can make it through that higher education. It's
all right.
An investment
in
our
thank
society.
Thank you so much for calling in, GS. I mean, registering to vote, we also have to talk about voter suppression and gerrymandering. Those are big issues. But we'll have our guest comment after I take a few more calls. Let's go to Ruthann and El Cerrito. Hi, Ruthann. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. I wanted to ask both guests what they thought about the strategy I've been employing for years, as I'm a registered Green Party voter, and I just wanted to know thoughts on reforming Democrats from within or supporting a third party.
Well,
all right, Norman, do you want to take that?
Yeah, I would distinguish between municipal elections, county board of supervisors elections, where there's no party label on the ballot for the candidates. And we see a lot of successes of coalitions where the Green Party has been very important, such as in Richmond, where the Richmond Progressive Alliance, which is totally non-sectarian, which is open and embracing people, whatever your party affiliation. And they've won tremendous victories, now 5-2 majority on the city council. That's a very different terrain than the races for state and federal offices, where partisan labels are essential to the process and on the ballot. And I frankly think that when it gets to running for the legislature in Sacramento or for the U.S. Congress, the Green Party is wasting its time, and sometimes even worse than that, by drawing in votes that tip the balance in the election.
Kate, what are your thoughts?
I would agree with that. I think I would love to see, you know, great Green Party candidates at the municipal level and, you know, in places where that might be possible, but at most levels of government, third parties are effectively locked out, and that's an unfortunate reality of us not living in a proportional democracy, but we don't. And the Democratic Party, as I think both of us have said, is really sort of the vehicle for change. And, you know, it's not, I don't think it's always helpful to think about it as a monolith either, right? And that there are certain institutions. On the one hand, you have things like the DCCC, which is really holding a fairly establishment, I would say, conservative party line and looking to, you know, influence the party in that way. But at the same time, you have local Democratic parties and state Democratic parties, which have been disinvested in and which are actually fairly porous. I mean, it's fairly easy for I was talking to someone in Colorado who is a member of the Democratic Socialists of America, and all of them got elected to the state caucus, and you know, see that as sort of a grounds for contestation. And so I think, you know, thinking of the Democratic Party in sort of the full complexity, the number of contradictions within it is really a helpful thing to do, just for really analyzing it kind of realistically. And I think you know, part of this equation, which the caller before last sort of brought up, is this issue of voter enfranchisement and disenfranchisement, which is just rampant sort of throughout the country. And you know, there are a few candidates out there who are campaigning for automatic voter registration, which, you know, in certain parts of the country, I'm thinking of places like Texas, you know, it's not that Texas, which, you know, is rumored to go purple or blue at any point. It's not that it's just so chock full of Republicans. It's that it's chock full of people who don't vote or can't vote or are encouraged not to. And so I would agree with that caller, just that I think automatic voter registration is one of the most important things that, you know, we could do to really make the country more democratic, small d democratic.
And also just give people a reason to vote, because what was it? Almost 100 million people didn't vote in the presidential election. That's a huge amount of people.
Yes.
Norman, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm going to jump in quickly. You know, we talked a bit about voter suppression, and it was striking to me when I was working on our report, Autopsy, the Democratic Party in Crisis, we looked into what the Democratic National Committee had actually been doing about voter suppression. I mean, the institutionalized racism against people of color, of poor people, to suppress their ability to vote, being enacted by state ID laws and so forth. And we found that the Democratic National Committee actually had been doing very little on this topic. As a matter of fact, they had until spring last year a grand total of one full-time staffer dealing with voter suppression, and then beat the drums and rolled the drums about how they were increasing the full-time staffing on the topic to four. When you look at the lawsuit that the DNC filed against Russia for voter interference or election interference a couple of months ago, it's ludicrous when you look at the amount of suppression of voters, the attack on democracy from the Koch brothers, from these ID laws, from racist voter suppression laws around the country, and the tremendous resources, both financial and especially political messaging, that the DNC has put into denouncing Russia, where our oligarchs here are the ones that are making huge impact against democracy.
And I would just add very quickly to in places like New York and places where there are sort of established democratic strongholds, the party actually depends upon a low turnout rate. It depends upon people not voting. And so I think that's something that sort of democratic machines around the country will have to reckon with, particularly if there are more candidates like Alexander Ocasio-Cortez who are committed to getting people out to the polls.
And Norman, given that you spent so much time on this report, Autopsy, what explains the lack of action from the Democrats when it comes to dealing with voter suppression? I mean, you can go all the way back to 2000 when Ari Berman at The Nation reported that Florida purged 58,000 alleged felons from the voting rolls. 44% of those people are Black, and Blacks made up only 11% of voters in the state at that time. I mean, you can argue that the Democrats since then haven't really done much to tackle purging voters from the rolls or voter suppression, as you just stated.
It's a very low priority, and I think, frankly, it applies to a comment that Bernie Sanders made to the New York Times Magazine a little more than a year ago. He said there are people in the Democratic Party, and he was really referring to leadership, who don't mind being on the Titanic as long as they have a first-class cabin. And, of course, the leaders of the Democratic Party nationally, they would like to win. But their second priority is to retain control of the party, even if they lose. And their nightmare is to lose control of the party, whether the party wins or not. And that's how the priorities really stack up.
Norman Solomon is a longtime activist and writer. Kate Aronoff is a contributor to The Intercept. Let's take a few more calls and then we'll get responses. Don in Berkeley. Hi, Don. Thanks for holding. Hello, Don. Did we lose Don? I think he got tired of holding. Sorry, Don. If you call back, we'll take you right away. Let's go to Emily in Berkeley. Hi, Emily. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me on. I am a member of the East Bay DSA, and I also do some work with SFDSA. So I just wanted to do a little bit of a plug of some of the local work we've been doing. We have our own Ocasio-Cortez moment going on in the East Bay between Jovanka Beckles and Buffy Wicks. Buffy Wicks is she sort of swooped down from the Hillary campaign and is going up against Jovanka Beckles in the AD 15 fight. Jovanka is from the Richmond Progressive Alliance and is a socialist, so we are endorsing her. San Francisco is also doing some amazing work. They do a little bit of electoral politics, but regarding this sort of like, does it help to sort of shift the Democratic Party or not? There's also some other options for what we can do locally to just sort of, you know, push through propositions and stuff. Like we did some good wins with Prof F and Prof H. So that's all I have to say.
All right. Well, thank you so much for calling in, Emily. We also have a number of emails. I'll just read a few and then we'll get responses. Mira writes, what about opening the structure so that it supports a multi-party system? There are at least four social and economic classes in our society, the abject poor, blue-collar workers, the upper middle class, and the elite. Under our two-party system, only the upper middle class and the elite are represented. There's no party genuinely tackling issues faced by poor people or workers. We are kicked around and ignored, and I'm really feeling it. Thank you for that email, Mira. Barry writes, it makes me sad to even hear the phrase the corporate wing. The question should be, how do we disenfranchise corporations? Tim in San Francisco writes, having seen my country continue to become more and more plutocrat or fascist, I was thrilled with the election and the Alexandria victory. Since both the Dems and Republicans have been captured by the corporatists, the real grassroots victory is hopefully a monkey wrench into the machine. The fact that she beat the money gives me hope. If young people particularly continue to vote, we still might have a chance. Dennis says, the issue really needs to be income inequality. People want a quality place to live, health care, and good education. These things can be provided by government programs or income redistribution. And then Johanna writes that it's a long email, and I'll summarize it. I get what you're saying, Johanna. She basically says, we have to stop the fractures because here's what we have as we're fractured. So that question, you know, has come up time and time again, Norman. What about that, fracturing within the party?
Well, I think that the last caller made a comment that bears on a lot of those email points that you just read off, and that is, are we going to recognize the reality of what the battle, so to speak, over the future of the Democratic Party really means? And the fracturing partly comes from folks not being engaged and not recognizing or getting clarity on what's at stake. I do think that the Assembly District 15 race is a classic example, a prototype for an effort to buy a legislative seat. And the effort of those who have poured in literally millions of corporate and rich people dollars to elect Buffy Wicks, it's just disgraceful. And we have a genuine progressive candidate, has come up through the grassroots, Jovanka Beckles. If Jovanka Beckles is winning this election in November, we will know that we've made real progress in defeating the concept that you can buy a legislative seat.
Well, Democratic Mayor, Oakland Mayor Libby Schaaf and Democratic San Francisco Mayor London Breed have both endorsed Buffy Wicks.
Yeah, it's disgraceful, and it tells you how corporatized the conventional wisdom is. We've got Jovanka Beckles, who has really, through her membership on the Richmond City Council and being part of the Richmond Progressive Alliance, shown what she believes and has shown can be done when progressives can organize and win. And I think it's really sort of a bellwether race coming up as to whether corporate America can just swoop in and just pick up another seat.
Hmm. So, Kate, a lot of people are watching that race in California. Can you give us other races that are similar across the country that we should know about?
Yeah, there's a lot. I mean, I think some stuff on the state level is really exciting. Here in New York, there is a candidate who Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has endorsed, also a member of the Democratic Socialists of America, running for a seat in North Brooklyn for state Senate, named Julia Salazar. There are candidates like Kenyella Ng, who is also a DSA member, who's running in a fairly crowded primary for Hawaii's first congressional district. Carrie Harris running against Tom Carper in Delaware. A lot of sort of exciting races coming up. And I think, you know, just to add on to what folks were saying about Jovanka Beckles' race, Part of what part of why Democrats haven't been terribly effective in the last several years, losing 1,000 seats, losing the presidency, is a real lack of attention to that level of race, to you know, state legislatures, to local races, and really building power for, you know, a progressive left-leaning wing of the party, I think sort of has to happen at that level as well. It cannot just happen in House races and Senate races, and certainly not just the presidency. And so it's exciting to see, you know, groups like the Democratic Socialists of America really investing in local organizing, and in a way that has sort of a long-term vision that isn't as sort of short-term focused as most even very progressive electoral campaigns seem to be, in that, you know, there's a way to treat elections which see it as sort of a means toward an end and not the end in itself. And I think that's been one of the really exciting contributions that DSA has made to some electoral fights is you know, having that much longer term vision in mind. And just quickly, sort of on the point about fractures, I think some fractures are good. It was, you know, a very good fracture when the Democratic Party stopped being the party of racism in the 1930s, with FDR's sort of realignment of the party. You know, I think those sorts of big changes can be really healthy, and I think that, you know, may actually be a sort of moment that we're at. And, you know, people have compared this sort of rising insurgency of progressives as like a Tea Party of the left. And I think, you know, that comparison is limited in some sense, but in the way that, you know, there are progressives contesting for every level of government, I think that's an accurate description. So I would look forward to some fractures and
To that point, Elizabeth on social media says, whenever a people's platform is formed, the Democrats accuse people of fracturing the vote, and that is unacceptable. Kate Aronoff is a contributor to The Intercept and a writing fellow at In These Times. Norman Solomon is a writer and activist. Be sure to check out the report that he co-authored called Autopsy, The Democratic Party in Crisis. And Norman's author of many books, including War Made Easy. Norman and Kate, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Rose.
Thank you.
Thank you. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We will discuss the fallout from Donald Trump's press conference with Vladimir Putin. Trump is facing a lot of backlash from within his own party, even, for denying Russia's meddling into the 2016 election. How are the media covering U.S.-Russia relations and U.S.-Russia policy? What is the real story here? And then we'll also talk about Robert Mueller's ongoing investigation. Where does it stand, and what does the recent indictment reveal? Your Call is produced at KALW in San Francisco. Thanks to Laura Wenis for producing today's show, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.